We'll resume arguments in Zenith Radio Corporation against the United States. Mr. Solicitor General.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The question presented in this appeal is whether the remission of the Japanese commodity tax, which is imposed on certain consumer electronics products only if they are sold in Japan, is a bounty or grant within the meaning of the Tariff Act of 1930. When the Congress required the imposition of a countervailing duty in addition to any duties otherwise imposed, whenever a bounty or grant was paid or bestowed upon the manufacture or production or export of an article imported into the United States, it did not define the words bounty or grant. And it then became the duty of the Secretary of the Treasury not only to compute the net amount of a countervailing duty that might be due, but also, and initially, to determine whether the triggering event, the grant or bounty, had occurred. Since a variety of governmental activities could properly be regarded as bestowing a bounty or grant, for example, a favorable property tax rate, or perhaps exemption from a property tax altogether, the Secretary required some guidance in defining these words. As we have set forth on pages 19 through 24 of our brief, the Secretary was not without direction from the Congress. In the evolution of the statutory language, and in the explanations of the congressional debates, it became evident that Congress did not regard the non-excessive remission of an excise tax as a bounty or grant. And we define non-excessive remission to mean a forgiveness of the tax not in excess of what was actually paid. In that portion of our brief, we point out that as early as 1890, in the sugar tariff, we find the earliest use of the word bounty in the context of the encouragement of exports. The record on debate indicates what Congress understood then by its use of bounty, and this was the remission or drawback of indirect taxes exceeding the taxes the exporters had paid on the goods. By leave of court, I would like to read one sentence from the remarks of Senator Gibson in the congressional debate on that act, and this is found at page 21 of the government's brief. And Senator Gibson, after giving an example, said, "But upon the export of a ton of sugar, he received back as a drawback $117.60. making a clear bounty of $20.54 per gross ton of sugar imported." This follows a statement that only $97.06 per gross ton was paid. So it is clear from that example that it was the $20.54 excess over the tax paid by the exporter that was regarded as a bounty.
General McCree, don't you think that the words directly or indirectly in the statute that we're presently dealing with might expand that view of the word bounty?
They might be so regarded, except in 1890, in the first Sugar Act, the language was used directly or indirectly, was also employed at the time Senator Gibson gave us this example, which would indicate that it was understood then just to indicate the excessive remission. It wasn't added subsequently. On page 20 of our brief, we set forth about halfway down the page the language of the 1890 statute, and in the second or third line from the bottom of the quoted language, we show that directly or indirectly was found initially when bounty was first employed.
Mr. Solicitor General, does the word drawback have, is that a term of art? It's unfamiliar to me.
It was my first acquaintance with it, too, if the Court please, and It's used, as I understand it, synonymously with, it means a payback. A remission may be an exemption from the tax. A drawback is a return of the amount paid. And it's been used consistently to mean a non-excessive drawback unless it indicates otherwise. After that first Sugar Tariff Act in 1890, in 1894, as we point out on pages 21 and 22 of our brief, a proviso was added to the sugar tariff that makes clear that a non-excessive remission does not require a countervailing duty. That proviso is found at the bottom of page 21, and it provides that the importer of sugar produced in a foreign country, the government of which grants such direct or indirect bounties, may be relieved from this additional duty, which was a countervailing duty, in case said importer produces a certificate of said government that no indirect bounty has been received upon such sugar in excess of the tax collected upon the beet or cane from which it was produced. And there again we have the guidance that the Secretary found in the early statutory history of countervailing duties. Finally, in this brief excursion into the statutory history, in 1897, we find that the statute was revised and made applicable to all imported products and not just sugar. And there, the proviso was deleted, but we find the addition of language which we believe, for the reasons I will state, to be a substitute for the proviso. And that language is that there shall be levied and paid an additional duty equal to the net amount of such bounty or grant. And we believe that the use of net amount means the amount in excess of the tax otherwise paid. And this would appear to be the intention from the floor debate that we set forth on page 22 and 23 of our brief. And if this legislative history, then, is proper guidance, the Secretary has indeed followed it consistently in his application and interpretation of the statute for 80 years, during which time, as my brother pointed out, the Congress has reenacted this statute in almost the identical language. We point out in footnote 15 on page 24 that the Congress had explicit notification in 1949 of the Secretary's construction and application of the statute, and nonetheless reenacted the statute, knowing that he did not apply it to the non-excessive remission of an excise tax. Also, and perhaps even more pertinently, in 1973, when the Zenith petition was pending before the Secretary, a witness requested an amendment to require the countervailing non-excessive remission, and that amendment was rejected. And the Congress, of course, was aware not only of the practice that is attacked here, but also of its application, indeed, to the litigant before us.
General McCree, do you agree with your opponent as to the allocation of function between the Secretary, the Customs Court, and the CCPA that he stated yesterday?
Well, the Secretary has, by regulation, imposed on the Collector of Customs this, or has delegated to him, the duty placed upon the Secretary of the Treasury, and the Collector of Customs makes the determination, which can be challenged in the Customs Court and in the Court of Customs Appeal.
What standard does the Customs Court use in determining whether or not the Secretary properly determined that something was a direct or indirect bounty?
We submit that the Customs Court determines whether the Secretary or his delegate has made a reasonable interpretation of the statute. We believe that this is a statute very much like other statutes that are entrusted, or the administration of which is entrusted to an administrator, either an agency or a cabinet officer, and that he has the right, indeed the duty, to make classifications to implement its application. And we submit that the proper judicial review is whether the classification is reasonable and to carry out the purposes of the statute.
Mr. Solicitor General, I thought yesterday that your opposition said that the Customs Court regarded this as de novo.
If the court agrees with that? I heard him say that, and I disagree with him. I don't think the Customs Court decides itself whether this is a bounty or grant. I think it decides whether the Secretary's determination is a reasonable one.
Then my next question is the one I would have asked him if his answer had been the other way. How do we know from this record the standards the Secretary employed here?
We know because we have 80 years of consistent interpretation, unvarying from the ruling made here today that the non-excessive remission is not a grant or bounty.
Well, certainly in this case, the Secretary didn't say that much. He sat on it for years and then came up with a trial was about what it amounted to.
If the court please, that is correct. And we would agree that a detailed reason would have to be given if the Secretary was considering something that had not been considered by him before. But here, ever since, as our brief on page 10, I think, note 5, points out, since 1898, in the first synopsis of decision, 696, has made this same construction. And after having done that since 1898, which memory serves as the year the Spanish War began, and unvaryingly, he has so interpreted and applied the statute. So we suggest that under those circumstances, perhaps he need not give the kind of detailed reasoning that would be necessary otherwise for appropriate judicial review of his action.
I guess all I'm saying is I'd feel a little more comfortable had he spelled out his reasons where we have judicial review.
If the court please, I share the court's concern for responsible administrative action, and I think that is something that administrators should do. But I suggest that when this is a consistent application, perhaps here we need not be as concerned as we might be otherwise if it were a new application. I'd like to suggest that not only has the Secretary consistently made this interpretation, but also the international trading community understands this to be the construction of our statute. And indeed, in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, an acronym pronounced GATT, the agreement which we have entered into through the executive branch of the government, because the Congress has not, specifically sets forth that the non-excessive remission of a consumption tax, an excise tax, that this Japanese commodity tax, as my brother would agree, is not the grant of a bounty or subsidy that would trigger the imposition of countervailing duties, which all of the subscribers to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade employ in one way or another. And so we suggest that here we have 80 years of uninterrupted, unvarying construction of the statute, of the original statute, with congressional reenactment 5 times, with awareness not only of the practice, but also of the specific application to Zenith, the petitioner in this case. And we suggest that the classification that the administrator has adopted is reasonable under all the circumstances, and so that even if this case fell outside of it, it would still be appropriate, as this court has recognized, if a classification is reasonable, although we don't have to argue that because we believe that this case is well inside of it. We also
think... You concede in your brief, do you not, and I take it here too, that GATT does not supersede an act of Congress.
If the court please, we do make that concession, yes, and that is correct as we understand it. We'd also like to observe that, as my brother has argued and as the dissent in the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals urges, this is not inconsistent with any of the decisions of this court. As Mr. Justice Stevens' inquiry yesterday afternoon brought out, in the Downs case, which my brother urges is a governing precedent and would require this court to rule to the contrary, we did not have an excessive remission of an excise tax simpliciter. We had there instead the remission of a tax and the bestowing of a certificate, which was a matter of great economic value. And as the colloquy between the court and my brother developed and demonstrated, the amount of the duty that was countervailed was either the value of that certificate or a profit derived from the exercise of that certificate, and was not in the amount of the excise tax that was remitted. Also, my brother made reference to other authority which he believed was controlling of this, contrary to the position of the government. We suggest that an examination of that authority would reveal that it is not. The Nicholas case involved a clear export premium. This was a case involving the export of spirits from the British Isles to the United States. And there, an express premium of threepence and fivepence on different quality or strength of spirits was bestowed. And indeed, the question there was whether there was some warehouse tax that would justify England giving this advantage found to be a grant or bounty. And the court held that regardless of the British government's purpose, it was indeed a grant or bounty.
But this was... Mr. General, you must have to concede, I should expect, that language in the Downs case is squarely against your position.
There is, the court please, we do concede that there is that language in Downs that's against us, and this court has cautioned us and other counsel that appear here many times of the hazard of taking language out of the context of an opinion and urging it as controlling in another situation.
Well, now, how is this out of the context of the opinion?
Well, if the court please, I wish I could answer that simply, and I'll give you the best answer I can, because I find the Downs opinion one of the most confusing opinions I've tried to parse in a number of years.
It has a lot of competition.
I would like to think that it was alone in this classification, but I have to agree that it is not. But Downs concerns a very complex system of controlling sugar prices within Tsarist Russia. And apparently every producer had to place his sugar into three categories, so-called free sugar, other sugar that could be transferred into free sugar under certain circumstances, and then surplus sugar. And there was one level of tax on the free sugar, and there was an excise tax that could be levied for domestic consumption. There was a double tax on the surplus sugar. The sugar in the middle apparently was subject to manipulation by a bureaucracy that oversaw this entire scheme. To sell the surplus sugar at the double tax was prohibitive, so nobody would want to do that. But apparently some of these persons would like to export that. And if they exported that sugar, then the tax would be remitted and it could go abroad. Now, it was not just the remission of this tax that occurred when it was exported, but also a certificate was given, a thing of value that permitted a person then to transfer from his surplus sugar to his free sugar.
In the domestic market.
In the domestic market, an equivalent amount.
Right.
And it was not the remission of the tax that was countervailed there, but it was an amount equivalent either to the value of the certificate or computed in some way on the value of the certificate. And it's for this reason that I respond to the court that language is taken utterly out of context.
Well, out of the context, perhaps, of the facts of the case, but not really out of context of the opinion in the case. And as we were told yesterday by your brother, it was understood at that time and by that court, he tells us, that the amount of the tax was not a reviewable matter and was not there an issue. The amount, therefore, of the grant or bounty.
Well, it appears that the parties conceded that they were discussing, conceded the amount that they were discussing. And I submit that if a court uses language not necessary to the decision of a case, that language isn't controlling, because a case decides a controversy, and this court doesn't issue advisory opinions. And if this language is to cover a situation not before the court, it shouldn't be deemed by anyone who reads it or this court to bind the court in another situation.
It purports to be, this statement, kind of the summary of the test.
It purports to be that, and in this respect it's confusing.
And it's not casual, inadvertent language, is it? It's quite positive and repetitive even.
It has all the vices of irresponsibility. But it does not decide the controversy.
But you suggest that he may have been in error, but the author was not in any doubts about it.
I would adopt that and wish that I had suggested it earlier.
The trouble is, it wasn't only the author, it was 8 other members of the court who joined it.
That's exactly so.
General McCree, by your version, the whole Miranda opinion is dicta. Because it addressed a number of subjects that weren't before the court at all.
By leave of court, I'm having enough difficulty with this problem, and I'd like to pre-termit a comment.
I think Miranda's had a lot of difficulty without being bothered with the debate.
But, Mr. Solicitor General, the fact the court has used dicta in other cases doesn't mean this wasn't dicta.
That's correct, if the court please. And I would suggest, too, that since Downs, the Secretary has consistently countervailed only excessive remissions. And the Congress has been aware of it, and the Congress must be presumed to be aware of Downs, including this language.
Would it be fair to say that the Secretary has consistently ignored the language of Downs?
Well, I would prefer to say that the Secretary has consistently recognized what Downs really held, despite the language, and has consistently followed that practice, and with congressional concurrence. And here we are concerned with a matter that's entirely within the province of the Congress. The Congress has established the countervailing tax, and the Congress can take this away, and I believe our job here is to decide what has the Congress decided to do. And when the Congress has specifically declined to require the countervailing of a non-excessive remission in the case of this very litigant, it would appear that the Secretary is indeed following the Congress's direction.
Mr. Solicitor General, could I ask a question that perhaps I shouldn't ask? It may be a little delicate. But at the request of the Department of State, you distributed a communication from the government of Japan on this matter. And Let me read from one portion of that. The government of Japan fully understands that the government of the United States is acting in good faith and so forth. In the unlikely event that the United States should proceed in a manner violative of the very international rules in the establishment of which it has taken leadership to further the objective of freer international trade, those countries who join with the United States in establishing such rules to promote economic development through normalization of international trade might be compelled to question the good faith of the United States. What does that mean vis-a-vis this case?
I don't think it means anything as far as the duty of this court is concerned here today.
You do not regard it as a threat to this court?
I do not, and I certainly circulated it only because it had been forwarded to us from the Department of State, and we circulated it for what it was worth. We don't suggest that this court should be responsive either to any threat or any apprehension of apocalyptic consequences in the field of international trade. This court's task, as we see it, is to decide what did the Congress mean by these words, bounty or grant, in the Tariff Act of 1930, as illuminated by the legislative history that we've written about in our brief and discussed this morning, and as illustrated by the consistent practice of the Secretary over 80 years, and as by illustrated by the understanding of the international trading community. And we think that this court, of course, would expect the Congress to respond in any way it deemed fit if the Congress did not agree with the statute as this court will ultimately construe it. But this court has the power, the absolute power, to construe this as it sees it in its judicial, informed judicial judgment.
Well, if in any event, you're here in good faith doing your best to uphold the position espoused by the government of Japan, anyway.
Well, if the court please, I regard my role here as seeking to uphold the construction that the Congress, that the Secretary of the Treasury, has placed upon a statute committed to him to administer. And the client of the government here is the Secretary of State and not a foreign prince or potentate.
You mean Secretary of Treasury?
The official whom we represent here is the Secretary of the Treasury,
yes.
who is the person required to do this.
You talk about the consistent administrative construction. Just to make it, so I'm sure of it, he has never had a rulemaking proceeding on this, has he?
He has not.
And it's all rested in adjudication, by the, it's rested in rulings by the collector of customs, and which in a sense is an adjudication by him.
That's exactly correct, if the court please.
Except that and that's subject to review.
And that is subject to review.
And so it rests in a line of adjudications.
Indeed it does, and very much like the Labor Board does.
Well, now,
do you
know or do you recall in your work on this whether the statute that was at issue in Downs also delegated power to the Secretary, or was it directly to the Commissioner, to the Customs, to the Collector of Customs?
My recollection is that it did not identify the person.
Because that case started out by a ruling of the Collector of Customs, I take it, and then there was a Board of Appraisers. But
that's correct.
But was the subsequent did the Secretary of the Treasury get into the act for the first time after Downs?
I believe the delegation is really to the General Counsel of the Treasury. By the Secretary.
Well, it isn't now.
Yes.
Well, I mean, but the Congress now delegates it clearly to the Secretary of Treasury. And I'm just wondering if under the statute that was in force at the time of Downs, that Congress made the delegation to the Secretary, empowered the Secretary rather than the Customs Collector.
I can't give you the exact
Well, I can find
quotation, but it was to the Secretary of the Treasury. He was the executive branch official required to...
At the time of Downs.
At the time of Downs.
Mr. Solicitor General, I assume that had the Secretary of Treasury back 75 years ago, after Downs, and all his successors since then had taken the language of Downs literally, the language that you describe as dictum, and there had been this consistent interpretation pursuant to the Downs case and congressional acquiescence, legislative acquiescence, as you've suggested, then you wouldn't be here.
I think that's a fair statement, if the Court please.
Your friend would have prevailed at an earlier stage.
I think he would have, Mr. Chief Justice.
Well, I take it. Do you know what position the Secretary took at the time of Downs?
The Secretary's position at the time of Downs was, as we indicate...
You don't think it was what the Court decided?
Oh, indeed it was not. When one reads the briefs in Downs and reads the record before it reached the Supreme Court in Downs, the entire contention was what to do about the amount of the certificate, the value of the certificate, and not the excise tax that was remitted. It was a thing above the remission of the excise tax, and that's the nub of our entire argument.
Because that's the way the case started, by imposition of a charge by the collector.
The imposition of a countervailing duty in the amount of that. In the appendix at 4951, the Secretary's view in Downs is set forth in detail. And so the government respectfully requests and submits that the judgment of the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals here is correct and asks this Court to affirm it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Solicitor General. Mr. Eikenson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I would first like to address myself to a question posed by Mr. Justice White regarding the role of the Collector of Customs and the Secretary. The statute has consistently given authority to the Secretary to determine the amount of countervailing duty to be assessed. The Secretary delegates functions to collectors of customs throughout the United States to assess countervailing duties to offset particular grants. In the Downs case, the Secretary of the Treasury made a determination that the Russian program conferred a bounty or grant and then issued instructions throughout the United States to collectors of customs. The Downs case arose in Baltimore, where the collector there imposed a countervailing duty in an amount equal to that contained in the instruction from the Secretary of the Treasury. And that was protested by the importer, who then litigated the subject.
And this Court agreed with the Secretary,
upheld the Secretary.
That is not correct, Your Honor.
Isn't it? What do they say?
Well, at the very outset of the case, the amount of countervailing duty was not put in issue for the reasons that I gave yesterday. The amount of countervail is not deemed to be judicially reviewable. The question framed by the parties was whether the Russian program conferred a bounty or grant. The courts below, the Board of General Appraisers and then the Fourth Circuit, determined that, yes, there was a bounty or grant for two reasons.
Well, so did the Collector of Customs, I take it.
The Collector of Customs made no determination. He just made an assessment of duty. He made no determination. The Secretary made
a
determination.
Well, I know, but his assessment had to rest on something.
It rested on instructions to collect so many cents per pound.
The Secretary of Treasury had made a determination.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So, and which the collector was following.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So in that sense, didn't this Court agree with the Secretary or not?
I would say not. It was not asked to agree or disagree with the Secretary's determination to assess a particular amount of duty.
Well, I know, but how about whether or not there was a reason for
countervailing duty? Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. They did agree with the Secretary that there was a reason.
But it could be challenged only by the foreign party upon whom the duty was imposed. rather than by any domestic competitor.
That's correct. It could be challenged by the importer.
The importer, yes.
That is correct. And I think it's very important to appreciate the kind of review that was available to importers at the time of Downs and continuing through the present day. There was de novo review before the Board of General Appraisers, which is the predecessor to the Customs Court. It is improper to suggest that the standard of review is review based on an administrative record, which then must be tested by either substantial evidence or some standard of reasonableness. There is a trial de novo. There has every countervailing duty case that has ever been litigated since the turn of the century has been the subject of a trial de novo, either before the Customs Court or its predecessor, the Board of General Appraisers. In the Downs case, there was a trial de novo. Downs argued that...
What issues are determined in the trial de novo?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
What issues are determined in de novo?
All questions of fact. A presumption of correctness attaches to the Secretary's determination. The importer then approaches the court, or in those days the board, with the obligation to rebut that presumption, to go forward and present evidence to show that the Secretary's determination was incorrect.
What deference does the Customs Court expected to give to the Secretary's interpretation of the statute, at least as much as we might?
I would say that they give deference to the Secretary. There are standard presumptions of correctness that attach to government officials' actions, and if that's what Your Honor means by suggesting that at least the kind of deference that Your Honors give, I would say yes. There is a deference that the judiciary...
Whether or not the Secretary is ignoring Downs or not, it is true that he has, for a long time, taken a position contrary to yours.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But isn't it also true that the Customs Court didn't even have an index of its opinions until the 1940s?
An index of its opinions?
Yes, sir. You say they were given this careful attention. They were indexed for the first time in the 1940s, weren't they? The Customs Court. Richardson did it.
Well, there may have been some assistance given to the bar for the purpose of helping research cases, but there are bound volumes of Customs Court reports going back to before the turn of the century, Your Honor.
Was that true before 1940?
Yes.
I don't get it matters, this case.
It is true, Your Honor. There were bound volumes. It might have been difficult.
There was no index.
Well, I'm afraid I do miss the point of Your Honor's question.
Well, I have a very hard time of doing research without an index. I mean, I'm not speaking personally.
Yes, ma'am. But I would like very much to turn back to Downs and the issue as put to the court. Downs argued, after the Board of General Appraisers decided against them and after the Fourth Circuit decided against them, he argued before this court that the lower courts were wrong. He argued that the lower courts found that the Russian scheme conferred two bounties, a bounty by reason of the tax remission, a bounty by reason of the conferring of the certificate. Downs made it clear to the court that this was his understanding of what the lower courts had said. And then Downs argued in his brief that the courts below were wrong on both issues. Downs argued that the certificate constituted a bounty. Downs also argued that the remission of tax did not constitute a bounty. This was squarely put before this court. It was briefed by Downs. Downs headed a section of his brief with the following language. The remission of excise taxes on the exportation of sugar is not a bounty or grant on exportation as the terms are used in Section 5. The government joined issue with Downs on both points. The government said that both the remission of the tax could be a bounty and both the certificate could be a bounty. The court then decided the issue, the issues presented to it. I would like to turn to some other remarks made by my distinguished adversary. He indicated that in 1949, Congress received explicit notice of Treasury's practice and didn't amend it. However, that is not the entire story, because in that period of time, 1949 and 1950, when the executive branch brought Treasury's practice to the attention of Congress, it asked Congress to amend the law because there was a potential conflict between Treasury's practice and judicial interpretations. Congress refused to amend the law.
Is that in the plural? Interpretations? Cases in this court? Downs and what else?
The Downs and Nicholas. In the Treasury Department explanation to the Congress, there was no specific reference to the court's decisions by name.
By name.
It said they were judicial interpretations. Congress refused. In 1973, the Solicitor
refused
General...
Refused and it just didn't... was there a bill introduced?
There was a bill introduced.
Did it get out of committee? Or?
It got out of committee in 1950. It passed the House, and then it died. The following year, it was introduced. It did not get out of the Senate Finance Committee.
Are those committee reports instructive or not?
The reports indicate that Congress was concerned about another feature of the bill, which would have provided for an injury requirement, which was not present in countervailing duty statute. However, the testimony, the committee hearings are instructive in that one of...
What about the report? The report indicated, what did it say about countervailing duties?
There was no mention of the second time around, Your Honor, the bill did not get reported. And in trying to understand the reason why the bill was not reported out, we can look to the hearings, and we find that there is testimony of at least one senator who felt that the conflict between the Treasury's practice and the judiciary's interpretation was not satisfactory.
Any reference in that colloquy to Downs by name?
Not by name, Your Honor.
Well, has it been our practice to give much attention to committee reports of bills that never were passed?
Well, I raise this, Your Honor, only to respond to my brother's suggestion that some weight should be given to the fact that Congress knew of the practice in 1949 and did nothing to repeal it. It was, in fact, asked to codify it and refused. That is my point, Your Honor.
Look, is it reasonably arguable that that meant Congress was satisfied with Downs to the extent that any of the members ever gave it any thought one way or the other?
I think...
That is the interpretation of Downs by the Secretary. I don't mean the literal language. The Secretary's interpretation of Downs.
That the Congress did not take steps to change
yes,
the statute?
That they were satisfied with what the Secretary was doing, notwithstanding this explicit language in Downs.
I think not, Mr. Chief Justice. I think if the Congress is told that there is a potential conflict between a judicial interpretation and an administrative practice and Congress does nothing, if anything is to be inferred, it should be that Congress was satisfied with the judicial interpretation.
Or is satisfied with the conflict.
Well, that is something that I did not consider, Your Honor. In 1973, the Solicitor General advised that a witness told the Congress that suggested to the Congress that the law be changed to clearly provide that the remission of indirect tax on exportation be deemed a bounty or grant, and Congress did nothing to did not adopt this suggestion. I don't think any great weight can be given to this turn of events, because Congress in 1973 and 74 clearly wanted to pave the way for smooth negotiations and for an international agreement. It did not wish to begin at that time to isolate specific bounty practices and instruct the Secretary of the Treasury that he must immediately begin countervailing. Instead, Congress did devise this very complex scheme, which I described to Your Honors yesterday. I think that was Congress's way of dealing with the problem. It wanted an international agreement. It did not want to be selective. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.